healing journey is really individual. It's not pretty, it's not easy to talk about, but giving yourself that space to heal from burnout or whatever it is, the patience to choose a different path and the confidence to choose a different path, and not listen to what other people say when they're trying to force you into a box. And primarily though, is just like being really kind to yourself. Life is hard. Life is hard for everybody. And the person that you're constantly hearing in your life is yourself. And that compassion and that kindness not only makes your life easier, but it makes you succeed more. You know, there have been studies that have even been done by that. And so, yeah, patience, kindness, and it'll be okay.
Welcome to the Break the Chains, Find Your Flame podcast. Our goal of this podcast is to provide insight and wisdom into all things mental health, to sit down with individuals and talk about their journey, how they've broken free from the chains that bind them, to find their flame, their passions, and purpose. Welcome back to the podcast, listeners. We are so excited to have you here for another episode of the Break the Chains, Find Your Flame podcast. As always, your host, Steve Wopalanik, bringing you a great episode with a great guest. Our guest today is Dr. Ellie Scott Gray. Dr. Ellie is from Scotland, but is currently traveling the world backpacking and has awesome insight on how to combat compassion fatigue and how to push through some of the barriers that limit us from finding our potential. We talk a lot about how early in our childhood we are met with societal pressure to know what we need to do for the future and aim for that goal, for that job, and how that affects our psyche and our overall motivation to follow through on passions and goals and dreams. Dr. Ellie has even inspired us here at the Promethean Project to put together some programming specifically on working with people on compassion fatigue and to create a curriculum that best supports them with skill building and support. So that will be something that's probably coming in the new year, so keep your eyes out for that. So without further ado, here is Dr. Ellie Scott Gray. Dr. Scott Gray, thank you so much for coming in today. Super excited to sit down and talk with you. I know that we connected on LinkedIn and I saw a lot of the messaging of what you were doing and where you're at now, traveling and doing a lot of writing. And I was really excited to reach out and have you come on because I think your story is really pertinent now more than ever. But, you know, I think there's a line in it that is really important for everyone to kind of hear who feel like, oh, okay, this is the only way I'm going to go through life. This is the plan. And then, you know, that shifts on them. So I'm wondering if you could give the listeners a quick origin story, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course. My name's Ellie, Dr. Ellie. I am from Scotland originally. And yeah, I always thought I wanted to be a doctor. That was my plan. You know, you start planning on being a doctor really young. So I started trying to be a doctor at 12, and then I got into medical school and I thought everything was going super smoothly. And then I started to burn out really seriously in medical school. And then I graduated in COVID, which was a really, really stressful time. And I had to go into the workforce early to help with the pandemic. And that really started like a burnout journey for me even more intensely. And I got really sick and I didn't know what to do. And I tried all these different things to try and make it better, even moved to Australia because I thought, oh, it's going to fix all my problems. Life's going to be amazing. And the burnout got worse and I got diagnosed with ADHD. And I got really sick and I had to stop working. And then since that point, I've really just been on a journey for the past year on figuring out what it is I want to do and who I am and how to live with ADHD and be a neurodivergent person. And so that has been, is that one origin story? Did I do that right? Have I told it in the right in the right
I
way.
think you're good. I also like the good old like, oh, I'll just move to Australia and everything will be fine once I
Yeah,
move. Yeah. I mean,
100%. I think
I think there is
that's
some
good.
credence to like changing environment being supportive to some healing, but again, it's like you're saying, it's not the end all be all fix to everything.
Exactly. I think people forget that when you move across the world, you're still the same person, you still have the same problems. And then being in a new environment, yeah, 100% can be really helpful. But then you forget about all the little adult stuff that you have to do, like get a car, get a credit card, find somewhere to live. And it's a very consuming experience. And I think I was a bit naive and just thought everything would be amazing, but it was definitely more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're already kind of overstimulated with what you're doing in general, and then you add on all of those aspects of living in a new country and having to get back to baseline, it can be really daunting and over even more overstimulating and overwhelming to you.
100%, yeah, I totally agree. It was yeah, overstimulating is a great way to describe actually overstimulating, overwhelming, everything over the top. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think you smashed that introduction. I think you did it really well. And I know after that you've kind of continued your journey to kind of figure out, okay, how can I process through, I'm not a doctor anymore. I can't do that anymore because it wasn't serving me. What do I do next? What did you find come up for you in that meantime where you moved to Australia that wasn't working and then you started that journey, like, all right, who am I? What am I if I'm not this?
Yeah, really good question. I think what was really hard is that, I pushed myself to such an extreme when it came to burnout that I couldn't work anymore. So it wasn't even at the start necessarily the thought process of, oh, what can I be from a work perspective? Because I couldn't work. I had to go home and I had to go through burnout recovery. And I remember I started seeing a therapist that was specialized around neurodivergence, which was amazing. And I remember her saying to me, she was like, it could take a year plus, a year, 2, 3 years for you to feel better. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. In your mind, when you think about leaving your job that isn't really cohesive with who you are, you think it's going to be like a party and it's going to be amazing. And you're going to start this new adventure and this new job and you're going to travel the world instantly and do all these amazing things. And it's not the case at all. I really had to heal and sleep and eat well and just try and remember who I was. Like being a doctor and burning out made me forget who I am, really. And so after 6 months of trying to recover, I realized, oh, I actually need to pay my rent. Like I need to, pay my rent, buy food, like do all these adult things again. So I just thought to myself, I don't want to go into something that's really high risk. I can't go be a doctor again. That was too much. And I just don't see myself going into like tech or pharmacy or any of those things. I thought they sounded really overwhelming. So I wanted something low stakes. And I've worked in hospitality since I was 13. I was like a waitress, I was a bartender, I was an assistant chef, like all these things. And so I thought, okay, that's what I'll do. Like really, like the worst thing that can happen is you get someone's order wrong in a cafe or whatever. So I'll do that. And originally no one wanted to hire me. I think they saw my CV and they were like, oh, you've been a doctor for 5 years. Why do you want to make cappuccinos,
Yeah.
But eventually what was really nice, someone did take a risk and they hired me. And they did say that they really only hired me for my people skills rather than my ability to cook and make coffee and things like that. 'Cause he was like, I can teach you that. That's fine. And so, yeah, and so I went from being a doctor to being a barista. And I was working as a barista for like 8 months. And that not only gave me stability from like a financial point of view, like don't get me wrong, I was making a lot less money as a barista than I was as a doctor. But it meant that I could get by. And that was really my starting point of rebuilding my confidence again, relearning how to speak to the public and speak to other people and be in a team and see that actually people like having me on their team and they see me as an asset. So that was really amazing for building my confidence. And that's really the starting point of when I thought, okay, what is it that I can do? What skills have I got that people will want to pay me money for. And I'm not gonna lie to you, like I'm still semi on that journey. I'm still semi on that healing journey, on the journey of figuring out where I fit from a professional point of view. I don't have all the answers, but I'm much calmer in that unknowingness, in that instability than I was a year ago or a year and a half ago.
Thank you so much for sharing that, because I think it's a really pertinent story, and I think it's something that everyone kind of goes through at some time or another of, obviously you're from Scotland, I'm from America, so the cultures are different, but I think there's an overarching theme at being young. The focus is, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to do as a career? And I remember being asked that at 5 years old in kindergarten. It's like, hey, what do you want to focus on? What do you want to be? And that message is so ingrained that we need to know who we are going to be in the future at such a young age, even to the point where when you graduate and you go off to university or to college, you say, okay, now you pick what you want to do for the last four-fifths of your life in the first fifth. And I think it's really daunting because some people know or think they know and they can execute it. Some people think they know and they can't execute it because it's not right for them, because they made that decision, like you were saying, at 12, and they're a different person now and they don't have all the information. Or some people don't know, and that's healthy to explore, but societal messaging is saying, well, something's wrong if you don't know, right? And
Yeah, definitely. We live in a world where your job is a massive part of who you are, and that can be for anything. It's one of the first people you ask, like one of the first things you ask people, isn't it, when you meet them? What do you do for work? Like, where do you work? And being a doctor was so intensely a part of my identity. It was my entire life. There was big parts of my life where all I did was work. 6 years of med school, and then you would be working like 90 hours a week. And even still now, I'm finding that difficulty of like kind of separating myself from that aspect of my life. But yeah, and it is ridiculous, isn't it, that we're expected to really know what we want to be as a preteen, as a 12-year-old, and onwards. And I think there needs to be more kindness and patience in like figuring out that journey, even after university, and when you're actually in the profession, you should know that you can change your mind if that's what you want to do.
I mean, it's funny that we're talking about this, and before we started recording, you were like, "Oh, who are you?" And I was, "Oh, I'm a mental health counselor." Even though I talk about this all the time, it is a tricky, a slippery slope to kind of fall back in on. But I think you're right, is people get stuck and, well, I've been doing this for so long, how do I make a shift if this isn't serving me anymore? Or I remember once I started doing mental health work, I wanted to go up. I want to be a supervisor. Then I want to be a director, and these things. And I found that I had accomplished those in my career, and I didn't like being a director at all, just because of all the responsibility. I liked connecting with people, and so that's where I started shifting some of what I did. Of even though it didn't have as much prestige, so to speak. Not being a director, just being a counselor, it really fit what I liked doing and why I got into psychology and counseling. And I also think an important thing is, like, when that becomes our only identity, when you're at that crossroads of like, hey, this is really unhealthy for me, or it's not serving me anymore, it's not only the loss of a job, but it's a loss of a huge chunk of your identity to sit back and say, okay, I'm going to make a change. And that's really scary for people to do, as you know.
100%. It's terrifying. And also, like, all your friends are also in the profession. So
Right.
even now, when I, half my friends are doctors and half aren't, but like when I'm with my doctor friends and they're talking about like what antibiotic they use for this chest infection and what surgery they performed, and I just feel like I can't be really a part of the conversation anymore. And I'm so proud of them, like some of them really love being doctors and that's great, but it is like it's a shift. It changes not only the dynamic within yourself, but it changes your dynamic with your friends and your family and even like society. Like society does see you differently when you are working in a job that's deemed as less prestigious, you know? So it's a huge shift, like it's a whole world shift.
Yeah, I would even say this has been coming up in a lot of my work recently, was when you start that journey to kind of heal yourself, like you said, that 6 months where you're like, okay, I just really need to focus on this stuff. That also can be really isolating, and people don't talk about that a lot because we see like this healing journey as a quest to move forward and be better and, you know, search for all the these answers in the world. But I think it is very isolating as well because, like you said, unless you're around people who understand what you're doing, even your best friend may not connect with you on that level because they're not going through the same thing. And that doesn't mean there's no value there. It just means that in those moments, it can feel like, oh, I don't feel seen as much because other people around me may not be experiencing the same stuff I'm experiencing right now.
Exactly. Like it is a really isolating experience. It's isolating, it's lonely. You know, particularly when I left medicine, I didn't know anybody else that had. You know, I was the only person I knew that was going through that journey. And then I was the only person I knew as well that was open about going through such intense burnout. You know, my burnout affected my health so significantly. Like my hair was falling out, I had severe acne, I had insomnia, like it was horrendous, and no one really knew how to deal with that. I didn't know how to deal with that, and then neither did anybody else. And so it was I felt incredibly alone at times. It was it was difficult, because healing from burnout, it's not only intense, it's not only isolating, it's not linear either. It's very up and down. It can be quite an ugly healing process. And also during that time, and there's going to be a lot of other people that have experienced this as well, but I was diagnosed as being a neurodivergent person. And so I was having to then unpick that and figure out why my behaviors were the way that they were. And, you know, my sensory issues got really bad during burnout. And so having to then explain to people, I need to leave because my sensory issues are too bad, or I need to go sit on in a corner with ear defenders on because I can't cope with how loud it is in here. And so I had to understand that that was okay. And I think it weirded people out at the start, like, because they've never seen me as this person. But it just takes time. And usually, like, friends are very loving and understanding, and they will become in tune with it. But it's a weird transition process.
Yeah, I think it's also really hard to say, how do I show up for someone when I don't know what's going on or I don't have a concept? You know, a lot of people I've talked to who have loved ones who are going through something similar or loss or grief will say, I don't know what to say to that person. And so I don't say anything. And a lot of the feedback I give them is like, you don't actually have to say anything if you can just support them and be in proximity and be a, you know, like a safe place for them to connect to, even if you're both reading a book and not saying anything. You know, that co-regulation can happen without words. It can just happen by proximity as well.
So true, yeah. Just presence, just being nice, you know, just being it makes a huge difference.
Yeah,
Huge
just don't be
difference.
a dick and you're fine,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Just be nice, don't be a dick.
I thank you for sharing that journey, especially with the diagnosis of neurodivergency, because I do think a lot of metrics that people talk about for this kind of stuff are based on neurotypical reasoning and say, just do this thing and you're fine. And I do think that's a broken part of the system of mental health or just societal health in general, is like, hey, conform to what we think you should do. And so many people chase that conforming to neurotypical kind of standards when in reality they're missing what's actually healthy and helpful for them because it's just not deemed that way by a typical kind of viewpoint.
Yeah, like I had to completely learn how to relive my life. And it's that typical thing of when people get diagnosed as neurodivergent, they suddenly say, oh, my life made sense. Like everything just clicked. And it is true. And that was a really wonderful aspect of being diagnosed. I was like, oh my goodness, like I'm not crazy. Like that, I just genuinely thought I was really broken and crazy and not helpable. and being diagnosed to change that. But it's just such a, it's such a difficult process of understanding your life as being a neurodivergent person, because you start to mourn the person that you thought you were going to be. You think like, oh, if I just try harder, if I just, you know, put in the extra hours, if I just do this, I just do this, I will be like everybody else. And then you never get to that point. And when you're diagnosed, you realize I'm never going to get to that point. But what was great is that being diagnosed with ADHD, and like autistic traits, I am the calmest and happiest and most centered I've ever been. You know, so a lot of good just does come out of like the chaos at the end. But yeah, it's a really intense journey, especially when you're not expecting it. When you're not expecting a diagnosis at all, it really takes you back. It's quite, yeah, it was a lot to experience.
I mean, I think it's like a living grief, right? You get the diagnosis, it's helpful in a way because it's like, okay, this makes more sense. Then you have to grieve that loss of self. And you were doing that anyways with like leaving, your job. And then, but through that, it seems like what you're saying is like, but you get to center on like, okay, this is, but now that expectation is put to the side. Here's a newer expectation on where I'm actually at. And that feels more fulfilling to work towards.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it really does. It's just yeah, a much more peaceful process as well.
And I think this is really important that you're sharing this. It's especially because you're talking about, hey, that this came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting it to come up. I didn't have an inkling at that, hey, this might be what's going on. And I think that's where, at least in the process of mental health, we need to get a little bit better because all our standards of diagnosis are kind of based on very specific markers, right? And so, here a lot of times I have clients who are girls and they don't get diagnosed with ADHD because they're not your stereotypical like boy who's bouncing off the wall with hyperactivity. And that's, then we can get into the subtypes of ADHD and autism and things of that nature. But I think people get used to just, oh, this is how it presents. And so they just pay attention to those markers instead of going back and saying, okay, it is very non-binary in how we do it. It's not just based on gender, but that does have a role on it, on some of what we see. But a lot of it's masking. Like people get really good at masking. And so it's a lot harder to connect to that stuff. And so we as professionals or people working with people who are neurodiverse, we have to get a little bit better at kind of seeing through some of that stuff too.
100%. And yeah, masking is also, it's exhausting. It's so tiring. And because you do it your whole life, you yourself don't even understand that that's what you're doing at all. So like an example that I always talk about is throughout uni, when I would like go out dancing or go to the bar or go anywhere that was really loud or a concert or anything, I would all of a sudden just feel this rush of overwhelm and just run away, and I would go hide in a toilet, in a closet, or I would run home, and I would just have a breakdown, like a full breakdown. And I told no one about it because I didn't know anyone else that was doing that. And I was like, this is really weird. I don't think this is normal, but I'm just going to bury it down and just not tell anyone. And then that went on for years. Well, it's really gone on my whole life. And then after going to therapy and talking about, you know, experiences after my diagnosis, you know, it turned out that it was my sensory problems. And so I was having breakdowns and meltdowns because I had such intense sensory sensitivity, but I was pushing them down to fit in and try and be like everybody else. But it took post-diagnosis to even understand that, that didn't even come up in my process of getting diagnosed. Because, you know, you don't know what you're looking for. You don't know what you've hyper-normalized in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, you just get really good at functioning either with like being overstimulated or, functioning in a way of like, oh, this must just be normal, so I'm not going to say anything, when in reality, you're insights are kind of spiking and like, no, this this is not okay. And you see it all the time with the sensory stuff because like smells can set people off, loud noises, stuff that people would say, oh, this is not a big deal. I don't smell anything. It's like, well, you're accustomed to that. This is overstimulating to my nervous system right now, and it's causing me to kind of go into a fight or flight response.
Yeah, 100%. And textures is a big one as well. Like, particularly when I'm going through a burnout phase, all I really live off is like smoothies, porridge, and toast. And
Yes.
people like judge you for it as well. They're like, are you having toast for dinner? Like, and you've had it for lunch and breakfast? I'm like, yes. But you just learn, you learn to cope. Like, and I didn't know it was a texture problem. I just thought toast is the only thing I can eat right now, so that's what I'm gonna eat. You don't connect the dots. It's so
No, yeah.
interesting.
And I'm glad you're kind of in that part of your journey where you're experiencing that. 'Cause I also think, I've had a lot of trauma in my life and a lot of background stuff. And when I was able to recognize that what I was feeling with some of the my responses was quote unquote normal for what I was going through, that opened up so much for me to kind of say, okay, I can try to stop the negative self-talk now and just be okay because I found, I talked to someone who has also gone through that, and there's a real sense of validation. Be like, oh, okay, you get me. I'm not alone. I can kind of move through this and kind of find space for myself a little bit too, to recognize some of these things are because of that stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I think the being kinder to yourself and understanding yourself, it makes such a significant difference to your day-to-day life because you're no longer that negative self-talk. You don't really realize how exhausting it is and how debilitating it is until it's released. Like, I used to be so horrible to myself. I just couldn't figure out why I couldn't live a life like everybody else and why I couldn't work the same hours and why I couldn't do night shift. And you know, that when you have like an answer, like obviously you can't blame every experience on this one thing,
Right.
but it does alleviate a lot of pressure on yourself and your life and how you talk to yourself. And that has made such a significant difference in my day, like every moment of every day, to be honest.
The most powerful thing I've ever had someone tell me was, you're where you're supposed to be with what you've gone through. And I like it's such an easy statement, and you could throw it away. You're like, yeah, of course, blah blah blah. But then when you actually sit with it, it's like, oh, I have this reaction because of what I've gone through, and I can find acceptance in that, or I have this reaction because of how my body works, how my brain works, or my nervous system works. I can find acceptance, and that's really how you start moving forward because you start building awareness and intentionality around it, as opposed to hiding from it. I have an emotional overeating disorder that is I'm in recovery from right now, but when I was going through it, I didn't know what was going on for me, so because I felt so out of control. And people on the podcast have heard this story, but I used to, have dinner with my parents, and then we'd pack up all the food, and then while they're watching TV, I'd steal more food and go into the basement and eat it. And it was very isolating because I didn't want to share that with anyone. I didn't want to talk about that with anyone. And I just felt like, okay, I'm holding this secret, and then it just kind of festers inside. And it wasn't until I found that diagnosis and then found like, no, this makes sense because this is what you're trying to do. Then okay, I can start shifting how I approach things then.
Yeah, I'm so sorry that happened. That's a really difficult experience.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But it's very empowering for me now because I can talk about it with people who might be going through similar things, but or maybe not the same thing, but know that feeling of feeling isolated because of these internal things that, oh, I can't show it, So you're traveling right now, and you're trying, like you said, you don't have all the answers. You're trying to garner where you're at and things of that nature. Do you mind sharing with our listeners just where you're at and what you're doing now?
Yeah, 100%. So I'm currently in Hanoi in Vietnam. I've been backpacking now for 2 months. So I always loved traveling. Traveling was something I always saved my money for. I would sell all my belongings on eBay so that I could buy a plane ticket and go wherever, whether it was working in a hostel in Croatia or I did some research in Malawi. Like I just loved experiencing other people's cultures. And unfortunately, when I started burning out, that love disappeared because I became really fearful of life and really fearful of ever leaving my routine and my schedule. And that continued to get worse. And originally, my plan was to go to Australia, like live and work there for like a year, 2 years, and then go backpacking long term after. But unfortunately, I got really, really sick and I couldn't even think about backpacking. And so I've been recovering from burnout, I would say for like a year and a half now. And over that time, I've been slowly moving towards a point where I felt confident enough to travel and confident enough to kind of like try and relearn this part of myself that I'd forgotten. And yeah, so me and my partner are now backpacking, and we're hoping to backpack for months on end. We'll see how long it lasts and how long the money lasts. But I'm honestly so over the moon that I managed to get to this point. Because I never thought I would. Like I never thought I'd be able to travel the world again. I thought it was too out of reach. So I still have moments where I'm like pinching myself, like, oh my goodness, like I'm just doing exactly what it is that I set out to do. And I'm also writing as I go around, doing a little bit of freelance writing for just like not only like a little bit of extra money, but also to give me more of a routine and more of a schedule, because I have
Nice.
learned that that's really important for me. But yeah, I'm having a really great time. And even like after this call, I'm going to go out and have some pho,
Ah,
and it's
so
going to be
good.
lovely. Yeah.
Plus, one of my favorite meals ever. I really like the tripe and, like beef tendon and all of that stuff.
Adventurous. Adventurous. I'm
Adventurous,
not quite
yes.
there yet. Give it time. Maybe I will be one day, but that's impressive.
Yeah, when I visited my brother in Taiwan, he was doing martial arts over there, and I went for a couple of weeks just so I could hang out with him. But I got to go to his classes, and we got to go into the countryside and go to like some Buddhist monasteries and Taoist monasteries up there in the mountains. And the first meal we had was a beef tendon soup at his like favorite noodle place. That's where he took me the first day, and it was the most amazing meal I had ever had, because it was just like the Western taste buds are different for sure, and to expose yourself to all that flavor was amazing. And I really, like you were saying, getting to know people's cultures and foods and things of that nature, it's so important to connect with people in that way.
Oh, definitely. You learn so much about people's culture from their food. Like, I would say my favorite place for food so far was actually Taiwan. Like, I loved it. Like, did you have like guao bao, braised pork over rice, those kinds of things? Oh my
Yeah,
goodness, I dream about them.
G Pie was one of my favorite like street foods. The fried chicken that they have there was
Oh
so good.
yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, amazing. And I learned like, so like they braise a lot of their pork and those kinds of things, and it was from when they were colonized by the Chinese. The Taiwanese people could no longer afford expensive cuts of meat, so they evolved like pork belly and things like that to suit a more like decadent way of eating, and that's where braised pork has come from. And so you can learn so much by just like experiencing all these different foods and asking about them. And I would have to say that food is my favorite part. My favorite part about traveling. Like it is just
Good.
amazing.
I love that. One of the things that in talking to you and kind of talking about like these changes in identity or living grief, I think one of the important things that I keep coming back to is like so much of our societal messaging is around currency and okay, what is going to help me live? How am I going to be comfortable? Things of that nature. And the sense I get from you is when you started, saying, okay, I do have to pay rent, but I want to do it in a way that is freeing, more freeing to me and not as detrimental, is that development of paying attention to different currencies in life that we have, right? So we have the monetary currency, but like time currency, stress currency, joy currency, all of those things are really important factors, I think, that come into when we make decisions on how we're going to live our life, how we're going to get move forward. But I think so much of the time our focus is like, well, how much am I going to get paid, and am I going to be able to live, which is super appropriate, but I think we kind of lose the plot if we don't start factoring in like, okay, how am I going to have time to myself, how am I going to chase joy, how am I going to explore and do all of those things. And a lot of times I feel like if you have a choice between maybe getting paid a little less money, but you could still live off it comfortably, but having more freedom and less stress, like sometimes that gets tossed out the window because, the title of the job isn't as glamorous as, the one that pays you a little bit more, but you have way more stress. And I think the messaging I've seen from a lot of people is like, we have to step back and look at that more concretely, N not concretely, but more with like a discerning eye, because I think we lose a lot of the beauty about living and exploring that way.
So true. And that's something that I was learning a lot when I was working in a cafe, because I started also working with a lot of people that were also part-time, and they were part-time working so they could have the time to really devote their own time to something that they loved. So I worked with a lot of artists, and so they were working part-time so they could paint and go to galleries and sell their pieces. And I worked with musicians, and I worked with people that also had like their own like supper clubs on the side. And it was so lovely to see people create their own way in life when it comes to work and play and time, especially because like when I was working as a doctor, I mean, in Australia it was a bit different. You did have people that were there part-time, and it's becoming easier to become part-time as a doctor. But particularly the first 2 years when I was working, everyone was full-time. Everyone was just like so dedicated to this one thing, and always we were always so upset that we had no time to like see our family or, go on holiday, or because you couldn't even pick when you went on holiday. Like when you had your annual leave, you got given it. And so it was such a lovely juxtaposition to then be surrounded with people that just saw life in a very different way.
Awesome. All right, so we're at that part of the podcast where I'm going to ask you some standard questions and, impart some interesting nerdy tidbits of comic book lore. But so the first question I always ask is, I'm going to give you both and you can answer however you want to. If you could have any superpower, what would it be and why? And then the second question is, what do you believe your true life superpower is?
Oh, great questions. So the one about the superpower, what would I want? I always thought it was like to stop time, but I can keep doing things and I don't age. Like I can just kind of do my own thing, have my own time. And in hindsight, I think it's because it takes me a lot longer to do things. Like I'm also dyslexic, so it takes me a while to read. It takes me a while to like relax and calm down, all these kinds of things. So like maybe subconsciously, I was just thinking, oh my goodness, that'd be amazing to have more time that I can just take on my own to kind of relax. So that's always been the superpower that I wanted for very selfish reasons, just so I could rest more. And then my actual, like my real life superpower, I think it is my empathy and my kindness. That's what I would like to think anyway, is that, I feel like I'm a really empathetic and kind person, and that's a part of me that I really like.
Yeah, it feels like it comes through. I mean, obviously, this is our first time talking and meeting, but you get the sense of the empathy kind of coming through and how you just look at life and how you talk about it. So that's great.
Thank you. Thank you. I know, maybe you'll speak to my boyfriend and he'll be like, oh my goodness, she's horrible. But I think I'm empathetic and
Well,
nice. So
I've learned that you have to kind of rule out the partner's aspect sometimes because they see all the warts and all, and like,
yeah, very
There's
true.
a level
Very
of it.
true.
I mean, obviously that he probably wouldn't say that, but when you spend so much time with each other, there are nagging things that do come up sometimes, and you just learn to manage it or talk through it. So,
Very true.
So I always ask, because I think it's a good summation at the end of the podcast to kind of do, if you could break down kind of what we're talking about in this episode into like a 60-second pitch, and not to put pressure on you, but just like a summation of what you want people to kind of leave the podcast with. What would you say to the listeners?
I would say that a healing journey is really individual. It's not pretty. It's not easy to talk about, but giving yourself that space to heal from burnout or whatever it is, the patience to choose a different path and the confidence to choose a different path, and not listen to what other people say when they're trying to force you into a box. And primarily, though, is just like being really kind to yourself. Life is hard. Life is hard for everybody. And the person that you're constantly hearing in your life is yourself. And that compassion and that kindness not only makes your life easier, but it makes you succeed more. You know, there have been studies that have even been done by that. And so, yeah, patience, kindness, and it'll be okay.
So, thank you so much for summing it up. I think that's the perfect summation of what we were talking about today, and the journey that you're going to. Where can people find, you say you freelance, where can people find some of your writing, or where can they follow you if they want to continue on the journey with you and kind of see what you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm currently trying to build like an online portfolio and website, so that's to be continued. But I'm on LinkedIn, Dr. Ellie Scott Gray on LinkedIn. I've also just started an Instagram for education about ADHD and travel and global health, and that is Dr. Ellie SG, and they're my main ones at the moment.
Awesome. And I'll put all those links in the show notes, so people, you don't have to run and get a pen and pause and rewind to write that down. They'll be in the show notes if people want to take a look at that.
Thanks.
That's fantastic. I'm
Perfect.
so excited to kind of see where you go. And I love writing as well, so I look forward to reading some of your freelance stuff and see what you're up to.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was such a lovely, like to and fro, like gentle discussion. It was really nice. Thank you.
Thank you again.